The Cappuccino Podcast brought to you in association with Tactical Solutions. For all your tactical solutions, check them out at www.tactical.co.nz.
It's that time again, so grab yourself a cup of joe
and get ready for the Cappuccino with Constable Brian.
So my guest today on the Cappuccino podcast is Jennifer LaSalle, hailing from Quebec in Canada. She joined the RCMP in 2001. She was posted to British Columbia doing patrol duties there. But in 2004, she goes to Ontario. For most of my New Zealand listeners, that's the other side of Canada, and starts her career in close protection. In 2007, she joins the Canadian Prime Minister's Protection Detail, and she's still there today. In 2021, she gets deployed to Malawi, Africa, as part of a United Nations peacekeeping mission, I should say. I guess probably her most important role in life is that she's a mother to a daughter, and she's a fellow All OK ambassador, so a huge mental health advocate also. So, Jennifer, because you just told me French was your first language, it's a very big bonjour to the Cappuccino podcast. That's about as far as my French goes, really. I play, the first initial thing is we play a speed round dedicated to Keanu Reeves because Bill and Ted, he's John Wick, and he's a nice guy as well, from what I hear. Best police movie of all time is what, in your opinion?
Training Day or Departed.
Oh, there you go. Okay, yep. The gangster element. Who's your favorite author?
Honestly, right now, I'm reading everything Jocko Willing.
There you go.
I'll go with Jocko Willing.
That's all I'm going to do is, and you'll get this if you're a Jocko Willing fan. Good. If normally we'd be filming this and recording this in my patrol car. So I turn up at your place of work. Obviously, the ocean's a bit in between there, so it's a bit tricky. What would be your coffee order if I said, hey, Jen, what's your coffee order?
It is straight black.
Oh, it's a lady after my own heart. What's your guilty pleasure? When you're not at work and you're away from everything, what's your guilty pleasure that if some of your workmates found out, they'd go, are you serious, Jen?
Yeah, I don't want to admit this, but probably reality TV like The Bachelor and Bachelorette.
That's all right.
Please don't judge me.
No, you're good. No, that's fine. No problems. I'm not. Do you collect anything?
No. I used to when I was a kid, but not anymore.
So you grew up in a very small provincial town in Ottawa. What does your childhood look like? Because if I'd said to you when you're a child, hey, Jen, you're going to go on and do all these amazing things internationally, you and probably your family would have looked at me like I was crazy.
Yes, they would have. So I grew up in a small town outside of Ottawa called Buckingham, and there was 12,000 people. And it's funny you ask that because I have thought about this later on in my career, where just sitting in awe and thinking never in my life I would have thought I'd be in Timbuktu. I was in Timbuktu for a year. So just, I think everybody would have been surprised and no idea I would have gone that path.
Yeah, because if I'd said to you that you were going to be at the King's coronation one day. Yeah, exactly. But that's another story. So you went to school. Did you play any sports at school?
Yes, I played basketball all through high school, badminton, baseball, hockey a little bit. But now mainly golf.
Nice. And you become a program analyst, even though.
Yeah.
And I like you and I have spoken before, even though you said I didn't want to do that. How did that come about? Was it sort of I should do an adult's job or what was the story?
Well, so again, growing up small town outside of Ottawa, Ottawa being the capital of Canada, but also the main government city in Canada. My dad was a public servant and it was like a safe bet to go into something along government lines. I wanted to be a police officer, but my parents were a little reticent to me doing that, to say the least. So it was, I wanted to join the RCMP, but they were more like, do something safe, right? And at the time, it was all computer. And so I took a course, became a programmer analyst. I kid you not, I would cry every day going to work because it was not what I wanted to do. It was boring. I couldn't see myself doing this for the rest of my life.
Yeah.
So one day I'm like, you know what? Nope, I am not doing this, not for the rest of my life. And that's when I switched path altogether.
And when you joined the police, obviously you said that you wanted to be part of the Royal Canadian Mounted Police. For New Zealand listeners who aren't familiar with Canada's sort of law enforcement system, they have the federal police, which is like the Royal Canadian Mounted Police, as well as their local police, which would be something like the Toronto Police Department or the Toronto Police Service or the Vancouver Police Department. What made you go towards the Mounties, Jen, rather than just the normal local police?
So in Quebec, we have our provincial police also, but the way it works is you have to do 3 years of police foundation, and then from there, try to get a job in a police service, and then you go to their training academy. At that point, I was a little bit older than people coming out of high school. I didn't want to do the 3 years of police foundation. So the quickest way in to police force was through the RCMP because you don't have that to do that 3 year program. So that's why I decided on the RCMP, the Mounties, right away. If that hadn't worked, I would have gone the other route, but it worked out. And I'm super grateful for that.
Here you are still. Right now, I've got to ask you these questions because for a lot of my listeners, their only experience with Mounties is from that awful TV program, Due South. Right. Yes. Yeah. See, I can see you roll your eyes. It's like, oh, here we go. So you don't own a Husky, do you?
No, I do not.
And can you ride a horse?
No, I'm terrified of horses.
There you go. Perfect. That's all good. Yep. So it's just one of those, you know, typical, stereotypical things. And I think, as I've often said in a couple of other podcasts with some people from the RCMP, I think when New Zealanders come to Canada, they think that there's going to be a Mountie on every street corner as well. But your famous Surge uniform, obviously, is a real big thing for the Royal Canadian Mounted Police. I've heard from some other Mounties that I know it's almost impossible to bend over in, and it takes forever to get the creases right and the boots shined and everything else. Is that a stock standard? Is that a firm yes from you?
Yes, and so it's very ceremonial, right? Surge is ceremonial, and we take great pride in it. So there's a lot of hours going polishing the boots, the belt. But as you grow older, sometimes it gets a little tighter.
So you're all good.
The breech is, it's almost impossible to bend your knees. They're just so tight. It's, you know, it's great pride, though, when we do get to wear it. Usually it's not under great circumstances. But it's always a pride to be able to wear it.
Yeah. Now you get posted to British Columbia doing patrol, which is a bit of a, I'm guessing it's going to be a bit of a culture shock from where you've just come from. Over in New Zealand, we say every police officer has at least 10, 15 great war stories. What was one of your hairiest moments when you were on patrol?
So just to like go back a little bit, from my little town, it was almost like shell shock coming out of like this small town into like the big great world out there, and just the pure geography also, right? Like you've been to the British Columbia, you've seen the mountains where I'm from, there's no mountains, so like just being there, it's like, oh my goodness, this is huge. And I grew up very shy, very very shy, so for me to put on a uniform and go out and assume that role at the age of 22 or 23 at the time, it was big. Like, so just going out in the world of policing at that age was a eye opener. But as I'm just trying to think, I think one of the stories, I guess, it was a shots fired call, or someone heard gunshots, and they gave us the address, and it was way up in the mountains where our radios basically didn't work. And we knew who lived in that area and gangs and stuff. So we knew it was probably legit shots fired. And I was going up there and I was by myself in my police car. Our radios stopped working. And this is pre-cell phone. Cell phones wouldn't have worked either. So I felt so alone in that moment. And like coming out and being met with the owner of the residence, I was like, oh, here we go. Like, I don't know what's going to happen now, but hey, it all worked out well. Here I am today. So that's all good.
That's all good. And that made me laugh when you said, you know, this is pre-cell phone era. To give you some idea and to make us both feel really old, I had a rookie the other day ask me about how we managed to get around when we didn't have GPS in our car. And I managed to go to my bag and pull out my map book and say, this is what we used. And she's like, that's really cool. But what happens when you go really fast and you need to go around a corner? Because, you know, normally the GPS says, and 500 meters turn left. So I got the map book and basically turned it around and went, it goes like this. And she's like, oh, yeah, I should have figured that out. Yeah, anyway.
And then you stop and you're like, I think I passed this.
If you get lost, ask a police officer. They're bound to know. So there was obviously a huge culture shock there, moving from your small, and like you said, when you go to somewhere like British Columbia, you see all those mountains and the snow and everything else. I do have lots of New Zealand police officers who struggle at the thought of how the hell do you police in something like minus 20 or minus 30 or minus 42 or something else like that. So just as a really brief, if it is a really bad snowy day, most of the time you're going to be in your car and it's going to be mostly vehicle collisions, or like you say, on the odd occasion, you're going to get call out. So yeah, it's not like you're freezing to death, but yeah, it is certainly different. That's for sure. So while you move, and after you've moved from Monterey, you go to British Columbia, you start to get an interest, I'm guessing, in what you guys call CP, close protection work. What brought that about? Did you see in the line of fire too many times or what?
No, at the time in British Columbia, I was married to another RCMP member, and this was not long after 9/11. So Canada started their own air marshal program. Mm-hmm. So it was a priority for Canada. So he got posted into that field, and I followed. But I didn't know anything about the work the RCMP did in Ontario, because we don't do general policing in Ontario. It's a federal division. So I didn't quite know where I was going to end up. And they offered me close protection. And I'm like, okay, what do I do? And so my first day at the office, they sit me down and they're like, watch this video. I'm like, okay. The video was called Bullet Catcher. And I'm like, oh, okay. Yeah. I think I get it.
Mm-hmm. All right. Yeah.
And so, you know, initially I was a driver for a few VIPs coming to Canada. And it was also in the time when SARS was a breakout. So it's kind of like no one was visiting Canada. So my start in the close protection was kind of slow, just because of the times. But then, you know, became driver, bodyguard, and anybody visiting Ontario, we would be assigned to their protection. In Toronto, this again dating early 2000s, there wasn't a whole lot of females in the program. So anytime a female dignitary would come to Ontario, I would be assigned as the bodyguard. So people like the Queen of Sweden, presidents and prime ministers of Latvia, Ireland, just a bunch of people, which was, it was great to work in like just the bigger picture of the world stage, you know, and from there it just kept
snowballing
up.
Yeah. So was that like, was that a huge adjustment for you to make after being on patrol? Because I've seen some of the planning that goes into protection work, and I have an interest in it as well. I've got a few friends that do it here as well. But I don't think the average patrol officer actually realizes all the background work that goes in behind the scenes, as well as, and you know what patrol officers are like, they'll see something and it's like, oh, I've got to go and deal with that. Whereas your, obviously your primary is your most important thing. It's not the fact that there's something else going on 500 meters down the road. So was that a really big adjustment to make?
It was. And it's funny because when you're on patrol, you're wearing the uniform. So you show up somewhere, people know who you are and expect something from you. In close protection, they don't necessarily see you as a police officer. So even dealing with the public is totally different from one to the other. There's a lot of politics and international, there could be international incidents if, like, you know, not everyone's on the same page. So there's a lot in the background, but it's a different mindset. You can't just walk in there and be like, this is happening. This is, you know, it's a different kind of, and you're not really policing, you're almost, well, not almost, you are 100% making sure you don't have to police, right? So you're trying to make sure everything's in place prior to the visit happening.
Yeah. Now, I'm not going to say New Zealand's a hick town, because it's not. We do have electricity and we've got the internet. That's how I can speak to you. Right. But in New Zealand, you can still see the Prime Minister at the petrol pump, pumping his gas. In fact, a couple of my colleagues were sort of advised that we shouldn't really call the Prime Minister mate when we see him at the petrol pumps a few years ago. But is that the same case in Canada, or have things become a lot more sort of tightly guarded?
He definitely does not pump his own gas. We're with the Prime Minister 24/7, whether he's in town here in Ottawa or anywhere else in the world. The Prime Minister's protection detail will be there, depending on the country. Our partners will provide security, also close protection security for them. Him and his family, actually. You might see him in town, you know, having dinner at the restaurant or doing activities with his family. He's very, he doesn't shy from doing stuff, but he will never be by himself doing that. It's mandated by the government and there's no option for him.
Yeah, and I have to say, ours isn't either, but on the odd occasion, they do sort of go wanderers. You and I both understand close protection, and often talking to people in multiple countries about close protection, one thing they're kind of unanimous on is being just sort of a face in the crowd and being anonymous is a blessing that most of us don't actually realize we have in our own lives. Would you kind of agree with that? I mean, for some of the people that you've done close protection work for, and I've done guards at different things as well, I don't think people actually realize what it's like to be not followed, but basically you've got to be on 24/7. And even just going to the bathroom and washing your hands, if somebody comes and stands beside you at the sink and goes, hi, how are you? How's things? You can't sort of say, just leave me alone, I'm having a bad day.
Yeah, exactly. Like I said, we're with them 24/7. And honestly, I would probably get super annoyed if someone with me 24/7.
Yeah.
I mean, we are there with them, especially in public areas, and we don't try to like blend in 100%. We're not like undercover. We're definitely not undercover, but we also don't wave the flag that we're there. So it's like a mix of being there, making sure people know that it's not free access, we're there to protect him, and there's a lot of case laws and stuff like that that gives us the power to make sure he's protected. Sometimes we look at him and we're like, oh, he must be so annoyed with us.
He
sees us every day.
I got to ask you, how painful are selfies?
Well, so I was on the Prime Minister's detail in 2015 when Mr. Trudeau was voted in. I had previously worked with our old Prime Minister, which there are two polar opposites. So the first, I'd say the first few months of the selfies, that was all new to us because the old Prime Minister did not do selfies. So it was a lot of adjustment and on the fly decisions for us. It is exhausting for us because the people are so close to him, and they'll get super excited and take their phones out quick. And for us, any quick movement is like, oh, what's happening? So it was a big adjustment at the start, but it's still now we've got a routine, and we've got our processes in place so that we can make it smoother and more safe and secure for him. But yeah, it was a big adjustment.
Now, I've got to ask this question. If I had said to your dad, when he said to you, "No, look, I really don't want you to be a police officer, Jen," if I had said to your dad, "You know that one day, you're a little girl and you're not little boy, and you're like a redwood compared to me. I'm the original Smurf." If I had said to your father, "Do you know that one day your daughter is going to be looking after the Prime Minister of Canada?" What do you think his reaction would have been?
He would have said, over my dead body. Although they were so against me joining the RCMP, and like they were supportive, but like any parent, scared, I guess. They are so proud, and especially my dad. It's funny because every time I'll see him, he'll be like, "Guess who I saw?" And he'll tell me, he's like, and then I told them that you're doing this and you're doing that, and they're super proud of where I've gone and what I'm doing, and it just makes me happy that even though they're scared, they're still proud and super supportive.
As they should be, that's all good. Now, one part of your life is that most people, they see your Instagram accounts and some of your social media and everything else, and they assume that you are living the life of Riley, so to speak, and that you're having such a great time on vacation, because you do get to go to some fantastic places. Like I said before, you went to the King's Coronation, you've been to Timbuktu, and all those different types of places. Do you think that a lot of people actually don't realize you're working at the same time?
Yeah, so I, yeah, it's funny because my aunt one day is like, "Oh, you travel so much, and it's so exciting to see where you're going, and how long did you spend in this location?" I'm like, "I was there 3 days, just long enough to like prepare event and then like leave." So yes, we do go to a lot of places, and it does look like I'm world traveler and just on vacation, but often it's long days, very short turnarounds, long flights, and it's we don't get much downtime when we're working. That being said, there's places I've been, I'm like, oh, I need to come back here on my own. So that's good. I've experienced it a little bit, and I'm like, definitely want to come back. So I do some travel personal, but most is work related,
Now, fame's
and
all,
it's very long days.
fame is all relative. But in your opinion, who's the most famous person you've met?
Probably, well, Prince Charles at the time,
But
but that was years ago. But many celebrities. I've protected Bill Clinton, like so.
Like I
I don't
said,
know.
it's all relative. Like, one person says, "Oh, wow," and somebody else will go, "Oh, yeah, they're not so famous." Do you have your travel bag pretty much good to go now? Okay, having done it so many times, could you literally? I'm guessing you have some type of mental list where you go, "Yeah, I got this many pairs of socks. I got this many pair of shoes. Boop, and we're done."
Yes, well, it's funny because if you go upstairs, my house in the guest bedroom, there's a suitcase in there that's always almost full. But there's always like the necessities in there that if we need to leave tomorrow, well, I just put my clothes and my kit for work. But like stuff like toiletries and my sound machine. I need a sound machine to sleep, so it's always in there. So there is a suitcase already. Almost already.
Now, I'm going to ask you, what's the one travel accessory that you can't do without on any trip?
My sound machine.
There you go.
For sure.
Yeah. To play white noise?
Yes.
Yeah, there you go. Because
hotels, and usually we're like, so when they give us our rooms, either we're close to the command post where a bunch of members will be working overnight, so they're talking, or near the elevators, so hear the elevator going up and down. So there's a lot of noise in hotels, obviously. So for me, I need the white noise, or else I'm up all night and I'm no good or no use to anybody if I'm super tired.
Yeah, I'm not going to mention the word cranky. I wouldn't be that rude. Right.
Yeah, I know.
You've been an instructor on several close protection courses as well, and also a driving instructor too for close protection. I'm going to ask you this, and you can refrain from answering if you want. What's the one thing that lets most potential CP sort of recruits or rookies down on the course? You being a chief instructor on that course, what's the one thing that most people sort of go, not very good at?
But before we get the answer to that question, let's hear from Jono at Tactical Solutions.
I wanted to talk about one of your favorite EDC bags, Brian, the Rush 24 2.0. It's been redesigned with a padded laptop compartment and a few upgraded extras. It's part of the Rush series with four different solutions to choose from. Come check them out at one of our tactical stores in Auckland or Wellington, or online at store.tactical.co.nz.
It depends, honestly. Everyone has their strengths and weaknesses, and you know, we do spend a lot of time with them because they're long courses. The mm-hmm. close protection one is a few weeks, and the driving also. And we don't want to set people up for failure. So if they're weaker in one aspect, we've spent a lot of time with them. But that being said, I could spend 48 hours straight, helping someone drive. Some people just aren't good drivers, right? So like, you can help as much as you can, but sometimes close protection is not for everyone. And we've seen people struggle with just being tasked for several hours at a time, where in the real life, close protection, you might be up at 5 a.m. and go to bed at 1, and you need that mental toughness and resiliency to go through to be successful in the real world. And sometimes we just see it on the course, and we're like, even if this person is successful on the course, it might not be for them. So sometimes we have to look at the whole picture. Are they struggling on the driving and the close protection and the planning and the bodyguarding? Like, are they like barely passing everything? And then we have to make the decision of that, you know what, it's not for them, and it's okay. There's plenty of other options out there, and sometimes just close protection's not for everyone.
Now, as an instructor, and I've done this myself with courses I've instructed, but I think after a wee while as an instructor, you actually get the ability to spend sort of 5 or 10 minutes with somebody and go, this person's probably going to be quite good. Have you got that ability now when the course starts, to basically sort of go, you know what, I'm going to ring fence this group of 5 or 6 people here. I think they're probably the deal. I mean, you don't go in with prejudices, but you sort of say, I think they're probably going to make it.
Yeah. And it's funny because the first day, just the introductions, you get a feel for like first impressions, and not that everything's based on first impressions, but then you see them interacting amongst their other peers, and then you see them in a scenario, or even just how they pay attention to your instructions. Are they engaged or are they not? And I think for me personally, and I'm just talking for myself, not the other instructors, but when I see that confidence, not cockiness, but like that confidence, I know, you know what, even if they struggle, they'll, you know, overcome whatever. And so for me, the confidence is a huge part, because if I see someone that is lacking and is self doubting everything, that's where I make the difference of like, yeah, you know what, they'll be good, and the other will struggle a bit.
Yeah. Now, being an instructor, I'm going to ask you this $64 million question. If your daughter comes to see you and that says, hey, mom, as you would say, we'd say mum here, but I need some driving lessons. How are you going to proceed? Would you go with it, or are they going to an instructor?
I would first say, come to me, not your dad.
Yeah.
So that would be the first thing. Yeah. But she already has come to me, and she's 15. So next year she can get her driver's license and here in Ontario, and she's so excited to be driving. And we've already talked about it. And I 100% will show her a few things.
Nice. Yeah. Make sure you have a black coffee beforehand. That's all I'll say. Now you've looked after and protected, to name but a few, like you've said before, you've been there with the British Royals, have been there, Prime Minister of Ireland, Prime Minister of Norway, President of Latvia, President Clinton, the Queen of Sweden. Now, we know that you're not meant to have any favourites. A police officer remains impartially impartial, as my old senior sergeant would say. You're not here for your opinion. Has there been any one person that's been like stood out for you personally? Somebody that you've sort of gone, you know what, if I'd had the time and you weren't who you were, I may have said to you, hey, why don't we just go down to the local coffee shop and grab a coffee and just have a chat, one person to another person?
So that might be, honestly, and I'm not just saying this because I'm here now, but I would say Justin Trudeau, for sure.
Yeah, yeah.
He's super nice to us and very personable. But I think on the international scale, the Queen of Sweden was amazing and super nice. Her detail, the people with her coming from Sweden, also very nice. And so like, it was a good, enjoyable experience. And, you know, even like she was telling me about Dancing Queen, the song from ABBA.
Yeah, yeah.
Everywhere we went, the song was playing. And she's like, did you know that they wrote that song for our wedding? And she was just like telling me about it. And so she was very nice. I enjoyed working with her.
That's all good. Now, I've got to ask you this. Justin Trudeau's favorite hockey team is the Montreal Canadiens, isn't it?
He's from Montreal. He has to. He has no choice.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, that's right. I just thought I'd note it as a Calgary Flames fan, so I get to cheer even louder next time. I'll tell you that, right? Now, you attended the coronation of King Charles recently. What was that like? Because that must have been a minefield. I know we're not going to go into specifics with security and everything else, but what was that like as a CP officer? That must have been, you've got almost every head of the Commonwealth there, you guys turn up. Is it a logistics nightmare, or is everybody pretty well organized? Like you say, you're not in uniform. You've got local protocols on the ground, and you're also dealing with local police. So how do you get through that?
So for the coronation, my duties for that was site security. I was in charge of the hotel. Mm-hmm. Where he was staying. So I didn't get to participate in any of the ceremonial swearing in or anything. But just being in London, I think everything went really, really well. Like mm-hmm. it was a well-oiled machine. And I think maybe they were prepared for that because the funeral of Queen Elizabeth had just happened a few months prior. So I think they already had a whole lot in place where they had just gone through something similar. So it was really good. And even working with the local police force there, it was easy to be there. That being said, just being there was very emotional. You'd walk outside and it was like positive and joyous moment, and it was just like, I'm getting goosebumps right now just thinking about it, because you know it was like flags everywhere and everyone was there on a good note and they wanted to be there. you know, walking around at night. It is London. It's a prime location or event for something terrible to happen. Mm-hmm. And knock on wood, it didn't. So, you know, at the end of the day, it was successful, but it was so emotional just being there for something so major. You know, like, it doesn't happen very often, not in recent history. So it was a great experience for me. Yeah.
Now, being part of the Close Protection Detachment, you're still part of the Royal Canadian Mounted Police, aren't you?
Yes.
Okay. How does that work? Do you get detached? So do you get reassigned to Close Protection work, or are you still part of, because like you said, you're still part of the RCMP. Can they reassign you somewhere else?
Like, yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
So let's take the Olympics in 2010, which was in Vancouver. So the RCMP, along with many other partners, are planning that. So a lot of close protection people stayed in the close protection roles, but those that weren't being used in close protection were reassigned to go do security or policing. So the RCMP is still a whole. If you're a member of the RCMP, you're still a police officer, you're still, they can call me tomorrow and be like, Jen, we need you to go to Northwest Territories because we've got something happening there, and so be it. That being said, tomorrow I could be like, I don't want to do close protection anymore. I want to go do general policing again in BC, and that's an option also, right? So if you're with the RCMP, there's so many options on both sides, my side and their side.
So, excuse my ignorance here. I'm going to call you a law enforcement veteran, even though you're only 27. But I've got two questions for you. All right. So the first is, what's the biggest issue you've faced as a woman in law enforcement?
I would say it would have been at the start of my career in the early 2000s. And, you know, we'd go to calls, and even if it was my file and I was the primary investigator, they would be talking to my male partner. Mm-hmm. So just getting into, getting into policing, you know, when women were taking bigger roles and not just like the admin roles and stuff like that, that was a challenge. And I would say even joining the close protection in 2004, even in 2023, the average is 10% of female officers in close protection in Canada anyways.
Yeah.
So just, you know, there's still a little bit of a boys club. So just trying to be part of that, I guess, and just, you know, earning that respect and that knowing that you deserve to be there, I think was the biggest challenge for me.
Yeah. What do you think has been the best tool in law enforcement that's been developed in your career? And you can't say the best tool. You can't say the internet, but the best thing that you've seen since you've been in the job and you've gone, you know what? That's probably, amazing. I'll give you mine. For me, it's the phone.
Okay.
Just the fact that, you know, we've gone from literally having to take Polaroid cameras around and the such like to everything's on a duty phone. It can deploy me. It can send me somewhere. I can do background checks on people, that type of stuff. So that's mine. What would yours be?
I was going along the same lines, technology, you know, like from like having to, you know, be like, Jennifer, are you available for a call, and pulling over and taking your notebook and be okay, give me the address. And to a few years later, the entire thing just coming down on the computer in the car. Yeah. So technology like that, just the easy access to, and I think it made our job a lot better because you get instant access or instant information on where you're going, who you're dealing with, and stuff like that. So technology has brought policing way ahead, but at the same time, it could be just as bad on the other side.
Yeah.
And, you know, and I'm just thinking, when we see in the news interaction with community and police, we often don't see the full story. And, right. and, you know, like, and I've got into many discussions, you know, and I'm like, well, I don't know what the story is, because we don't know what the background on that individual is, on that police officer. We don't know anything about anything except for the actions. And so I think technology is leaps and bounds ahead, but at the same time, it's hard. I think it's harder to be a police officer, because every time you do go to a call, or you're in the public eye, and it's, you know, I just hope that police officers get or make their decisions on their instinct, on their training, and not because, or hesitate because of fear of something. And I don't want the police officers to doubt themselves and their aptitude because of fear.
Yeah, like I always say to people, you know, when I started in 1996, we used to have people assist us at roadside accidents. And now we have an awful lot of people just film as they go past, which is speaks a lot about humanity, not just policing. So speaking of humanity, in 2021, and I'm going to have to look down at my sheet to get this all right, you are deployed to Malawi, Africa. It is the eighth largest country in Africa, population 22 million, roughly. Gold and salt exports, predominantly Muslim nation, French speaking, which is, I'm guessing, one of the reasons you got the job. You go to the city of Timbuktu. Yes, there is actually a place called Timbuktu.
That's right.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. How did that all come about? Because that doesn't happen by accident, does it? It's not like you're sitting around doing CP one day and they go, hey, Jen, let's send you to Timbuktu. So how did your application go, and how did you find out about it?
So when I joined in 2001, the RCMP, there was a lot of RCMP members being deployed with the United Nations. And I always was fascinated by that. And for my entire career, so every year you have to submit a learning plan and a career interest form. And every year from the start of my career, UN peacekeeping mission was on that form. So it's not something that just came about one day. It's always been in my mind. Earlier in my career, I wanted to do it, but I didn't have enough service. I was too young, too junior in service. Then I had my daughter, and I couldn't even fathom like leaving for a year and leaving my child. When COVID hit, I was working from home because I had an admin job at the time. I was kind of bored. I'm like, I don't want to do this. I don't want to do this. And I spoke to my supervisor, and he's like, well, I know you've always wanted to do a mission, and they are looking for female members to deploy to Africa. And I'm like, oh, like I almost had slipped my mind. So first person I called was my daughter. Well, my ex-husband, daughter's father, to ask. He's like, you know, you've always wanted to do it. I support you 100%. Then I went to my daughter, asked her, and she's like, okay, well, you know, so I explained I would come home every 6-8 weeks. And so everyone was very supportive, scared, but supportive. And I put my name in, and I got, they asked if I wanted to go to Mali or Congo. There was a few missions, and I'm like, just send me wherever you need me. And they sent me to Mali. And the thing is, when they're like, you're going to Mali, I'm like, I don't know where that is.
Yeah.
Like, I know it's in Africa, but I know nothing about it. So prior to deploying, you get the 3-week course on, you know, the history and everything. And it's funny because when I was a kid or a teenager, a sassy teenager, and my dad would say, where are you going? I would always say, I'm going to Timbuktu, you know, just to be a little, you know, pain in the butt. So when I got the actual deployment of Timbuktu, I'm like, Dad, guess what? And he's like, you're lying. I'm like, no, I'm actually going to Timbuktu, which, again, I didn't even know it was in Mali. But so, yeah, I spent a year in Timbuktu.
Yeah. Now, That's what I'm definitely going to have to read. You were part of the United Nations Integrated Multidimensional Stabilization in Mali. When you were in Mali, you were a training coordinator and an instructor, providing training to the local police force. What was that like? That must have been culture shock and then some.
For everyone. Yeah. So, yes, my job initially started as community policing, but I soon went into the training, and it was, I still like, I'm so proud of having done that, because you could, they don't get the training they need as police officers. There's no infrastructure for that. There's no money for it. So the United Nations would come and give them like tools and the training on everything from arrest procedures to taking statements to gathering evidence, everything. And you would see the progression from the Monday to the Friday. And to me, that was the most satisfying. And just, I felt like we provided something, and you could see their skills improve in like 5 days. That being said, the first day I showed up in class, what class? I have to say class.
Yeah, yeah, that's okay.
Quickly,
yeah.
Because it was legit a open garage in the middle of like the desert. So, but I show up and all the local police officers are 20 to 25. And then there's me coming from, you know, well, yep. They thought it was Europe, but yep. You know, North America. And so, and being a woman, I was the first, female instructor. And at the start, it's like, they didn't know if they should be listening or like taking any advice from me.
Yeah.
But honestly, I still talk to or get messages from a bunch of them, and you know, they still thank us and say, you know, I still put in practice what you taught me. And so it was a culture shock, but it was so rewarding. And yeah. I'm so glad I did it. Yeah,
I think that was the first photo I ever saw of you, was in your UN beret surrounded by a whole bunch of children from Malawi. And I was like, yeah, this is somebody I've definitely got to have a chat to for a podcast. Now, when you're in Mali, COVID raised its head. What was that like? That must have been pretty nerve-wracking. Were you all a little bit sort of worried about what would happen, and how did you cope with it all? Because I've been to Pacific Island countries where they have said, you know, when COVID hit, we had nothing. So was that a bit of a nerve-wracking time for you?
Yes. So I got to, we first arrived in Mali. You get a 1 month or 4 week induction training, and from there you go into the region. So I got to Timbuktu in November of 2021, and at the end of November I got COVID, and I was so scared because the infrastructure is not there, the equipment is not there, and I'm like, I didn't know how COVID would affect me.
Yeah.
You know, because I had never gotten it before, and I was so scared that what if I need to be on a ventilator or, you know, or need like the care, it's not there. And so the fear of like needing care was more than the actual COVID.
Yeah.
You know, I went to the medical clinic on base, and the doctor told me I had to stay in my room for 2 weeks, and I'm like, wow. I have a bed and a toilet here. I'm like, how do I get food? So thank goodness for my Canadian colleagues there. There was four of us. So the three of them really, you know, would bring me my food. And they even snuck a dumbbell from the gym so I could work out in my room. We're not telling this. We did bring it back.
Yeah.
But missing for 2 weeks.
Yeah.
But so it was scary at the time, but at the end of the day, everything worked out.
Yeah.
Now, in our favor.
When you were there, was there any time that you thought, because I mean, I know people have done US peacekeeping missions to the Pacific Islands up here, and they're on the odd occasion, they say you have this moment, this realization that you and your buddies are it. you know, you can't radio for backup. And even if you do, they're sort of at least maybe 3 to 4 days away. When you had those moments, was it a matter of just sort of taking a deep breath, focusing on the mission and moving on? Or how did you cope with it?
I'm like, how much time do we have now? So yes, that day definitely did happen. And I'll try to be quick in my story, but it was a Good Friday, and we're all still in bed. It's like 6 o'clock in the morning, and I hear the air raid siren going, and I'm like, oh, that's early for practice. I'm like, oh, it's Friday at 6 a.m. This is not a practice. And by the time my brain realized this, the bombs or the rockets were already falling in the camp. And once the rockets stopped, eventually, you know, I had all my gear go into the bunkers. And then I stood there and I was looking around, and I'm like, okay, well, luckily for us, Canada has equipped us with like the best equipment you could ask for. And I'm like, I'm ready for this. Like, my mindset was like, bring it on. If you're going to attack the base, bring it. I'm ready. But as I looked around, I'm like, not everybody had the same equipment. And that's when I realized, okay, well, it's us against them, right? And even us, I'm like, it's going to be like, you know, the countries that are equipped that are going to have to take control and take over. So definitely there was a moment where, and I cried, and I cried that night, and I'm like, it's us, like it's us. And but threat is real, like the bombs actually did, like, you know, and there has been ambushes on the UN convoys. And so I'm like, the threat is real, the threat is there. We're a target, and it's us. And, you know, and I'm like, why am I here? And then, you know, we go on patrol, and I see the little kids running around and with their soccer ball, and I'm like, this is why we're here. Like, you know, and so I had to remind myself, and you know, it was a lot of self-reflection and, you know, taking just deep breath and saying, okay, no, we're here for them, and let's do this, let's do our best.
So 30th of June 2023, the United Nations has decided to end MINUSMA mandate and withdraw. What are your, and I know that you've got to remain impartial here, like I do. What are your feelings and thoughts on that? Having been boots on the ground, do you worry for some of the locals that you've interacted with, Jen, or not?
Oh, 100%. And you know, like, we visited schools and, you know, orphanages and stuff, and yes, I'm terrified for the Malian population. And even now, like, the MINUSMA is not even out 100%.
You still stay in contact with them. There's not much more that you can do than that, is it? Worry for the people that you've been with.
No, and with the mission pulling out of Mali, I'm like terrified for the population. But the police officers that I now know personally, and even all the civilian members that worked at the base, you know, at the store, at the mess, or linguistic people, it's just, that's their life, and they don't get to leave. They need to stay there, and that's like super scary. And I fear for them because, yes, the Malian forces are trying to push back the terrorists, but it's failing miserably right now. And it's very scary to know that the UN pulling out is, you know, it's not positive. It's not a positive outlook, and it's scary and sad. And heartbreaking.
Yeah. And I'm guessing you still keep an eye on it every now and then when you can.
Every day.
Yeah, I bet. Yeah. All right. So, you, changing the subject, you are a huge mental health advocate. You're a fellow all okay, Ambassador? Let's be honest, that's how we met. What sparked your interest in mental health, particularly for law enforcement officers and service personnel?
Initially, like years ago, I was talking to colleagues, and we had gone to a motor vehicle accident months before. And there's three youths, they all passed away. And we were talking about that accident. And one of the police officers clearly was not dealing. You could see he was affected. Mm-hmm. And we weren't as affected as he was. And I was like, what's happening, right? And this is before, you know, mental health was like so open, and PTSD, you know. And so to me, it was always like being there for my colleagues. But then at the same time, I realized, hey, I'm not the same person I used to be. Whether I'm hypervigilant or like I it changed me, and mm-hmm. I would go through periods of I'm not okay, I'm tired. And then people were talking about mental health and PTSD, and then it's like, you know, when I saw All Okay and they're like, no, let's talk about this, let's be so open, and I'm like, yes, let's, we have to talk about this. And you know, like I've seen people struggle and just like pushing people away and not just isolating themselves. And it's scary because you're like, no, like, don't go, but it's hard to like bring someone back. And so I'm like, I'm in, and let's promote open discussion, mental health awareness. Let's talk about PTSD. And mm-hmm. even I was at work a few weeks back, and we're talking about PTSD. And I said, you know, it's funny because when you talk about PTSD, people automatically picture what you see in movies where it's like, you know, someone going rogue and, you know, like
yeah.
all hell breaks loose. And I'm like, no, like for me, my PTSD is social isolation. I just want to stay home in my comfort zone. And, you know, so it doesn't have to be extreme, but, you know, it can be. So like, it's, let's talk about this. And what is it to different people? Let's not assume that PTSD means you're going to go rogue and, you know, like do yep. stupid stuff.
Yeah.
So for me, like it's, we need to talk about it. And, you know, I'm so glad that people are starting to open up, and businesses like All Okay are promoting that discussion.
Yeah. What so are important. You're not wrong. What do you do? Everybody's got something different. For me, and you're going to laugh at this as a Canadian, I come home because the hockey games are on at the most ridiculous times here. sometime between 3 and 7 in the afternoon. So sitting like I was yesterday in 28 degree heat, I'm watching the Calgary Flames play. For me, that's my thing. I watch a game that hardly anybody in New Zealand watches. I relax. I know the players. I've been to this dome, blah, 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 et cetera, et cetera. I get to have my sort of one period of chill time, and I'm all good. What do you do for your mental health on a daily basis and your physical health? I mean, every cop says, yeah, I work out. Well, I hope every cop says, yeah, I work out. Yeah, you and I both know that there are a few that don't. I go to the gym every day, yeah, and I'm pretty sure you do. But what do you do for your mental health and your physical health?
I like to, like, just pull it back and – I'll be honest, I listened to this one, I guess, artist or station on Spotify and Amazon, and honestly, that one station got me through my mission. And I listened to their songs and speeches, and it just makes me like ground myself and be like, okay, you know what? Bad day, or I'm feeling like this, but here I am, let's change it. And like it, so I will take time, and even I might just go in my bedroom and lock the door and be like, give me 15 minutes. I need 15 minutes just to like connect. So sometimes I'll go in my bedroom and lock the door, or I've got a infrared sauna. I will go into the sauna for that 20 minutes listening to that one station just over and over again, and like just ground myself, charge up, and then I'll be ready to go.
Yeah, that's all good. And who knew that you're a big Kiss fan like I am? Detroit Rock City's helped me through many a bad time. That's all I say about it, all right? Yeah, just leave it there. Let everybody's imaginations go wild, Jen. Okay, so law enforcement has certainly changed in the time that you and I have both been in service. What do you think that we could be doing for all of law enforcement that we could improve mental health for our law enforcement officers, first responders, and service personnel? Like you're saying, a lot of us are talking a lot more, which is a great thing. A lot of people are listening a lot more, which is an even better thing. How do I put this? And I said, I see there's lots of different groups trying to do stuff, and they're great. They're kind of doing stuff, but they're not really doing much apart from the, hey, can we help you in some way? And there doesn't seem to be anybody sort of substance behind that. What's one simple thing that you think we could all be doing as cops, as first responders, as service personnel to help us all with our mental health?
Well, and last week, the RCMP came out with a new initiative. So every year or 3 years, depending on the section, you have to do your medical testing and exams. But now they're implementing a mental health component to this. And I'm super happy to see this, because when I went on the mission, when it came back, it was mandatory to have a psychological follow-up, which was at 1 week, 1 month, 3 months. And I think it should be mandatory. Mm-hmm. Even just going and sitting, and sometimes you talk and you're like, oh, I didn't even know I was doing this, or I didn't know that it affected me. For me, do a mandated follow-up for law enforcement. I think it's necessary, especially what are the stats? 1 in 19 police officers struggles with mm-hmm. some sort of mental health. So just to know and encourage that dialogue, and when you see someone that's not doing okay, or that you're questioning whether they are, bring it up. You have to ask them, because you will notice someone detaching from themselves most likely, or overcompensating on being happy. And, you know, so if there's a change in their behavior, that's a flag, and to either bring it up with them or someone else. I think we have to look out for each other, and I think to respect each other also and not judge is what we need, like, to support each other.
Not wrong. Now, two questions for you. Last two questions, I should say. If Senior Police Officer Jen LaSalle meets baby Jen LaSalle at coming out of the RCMP, you guys have depots there, I think, or a training base, and baby Jen comes up to Senior Police Officer Jen and says, what's one piece of advice you'd give me for my law enforcement career? What would you say to her?
Okay. My trainer, when I came out of the academy, at one point he said, when in doubt, go left. And to me, it was always like, if you're at an intersection, go left, because that's right is easy. And I was talking to him not long ago, actually, and I'm like, to this day, I still use that, but not while driving. It's like, when you're faced with a decision, left is the harder turn. Mm-hmm. Always take the harder turn. Push yourself. Get out of your comfort zone. So for me, I'd be like, you will be scared of taking that decision or making that decision or taking a new job or applying for a new job, whatever. Don't let fear stop you. And when in doubt, go left.
There you go. Perfect. Unlike Jack Reacher, who always goes right, I think it is. But that's all right. Anyway, yeah. So, but that's when he's hunting suspects. So you're all good. Final question, eulogy question for you. It's the question we always ask. The day of reckoning has come for you. And in a sort of bizarre twist of fate, you're lying in your coffin, but you can hear people delivering your eulogy. What would you like them to say about you? It's a tricky one, isn't it? Yeah.
It is.
I've had everything from the bears are on me, to he was a really good bastard, and we're all gonna miss him quite a bit.
Oh, well, I hope they would miss me.
Yeah,
Well,
yeah,
I'd come back to haunt them if they're like, oh,
yeah.
good
Yeah,
riddance.
yeah.
No, I would want to say I would want them to think I did my best and tried to treat everyone with respect and just be a good friend and a good person and yeah, just loyal and honest. And I hope that's how they see me,
And
or
with
at
that,
least lie and say
yeah, of course, yeah. With that, it
it.
is a big merci beaucoup, au revoir to Jen. There you go. Those are my other two, three words of French. Thank you very much for taking the time. I know it's busy.
Thank you so much.
Thanks for listening. But please do Constable Brian and I a favour and be sure to subscribe so you don't miss out on the next Coppuccino podcast. Real people, real stories.